And yes, if we think of it as my body, if we think it's the world, we do get caught up in that separation. Sometimes when we pay attention, we get interested, we get absorbed. It's almost like we become one with whatever it is that we're being absorbed around. So doing a mantra, you can like almost become the mantra. You can be your breathing body rather than thinking or experiencing your breathing body as something separate. You know, that sense of just being part of the world, interconnected. Or just that sense of being stillness. Being silence. Being space. And that sense of inhabiting, being your body, being your breathing body. Feeling that contact with the ground. If you're sitting on a chair, the soles of your feet, the pads of the toes, in contact with the floor. Buttocks, the sitting bones with your seat. Or if you're on cushions or stool, maybe the knees are in contact with the ground, the lower legs, the upper part of the foot. But just being aware of that contact, experiencing the sensation of that contact, that sensation of touch, and maybe again that sense of being so aware, so part, so absorbed in that, that you can feel that contact and not feel yourself as separate, feel yourself part of the earth, like a tree rooted growing up towards the sky. Being aware of the whole body in this particular posture. Shoulders aligned with the hips. Ears roughly above the shoulders. Broadening, widening, softening around the back, the shoulders. We have the spine from the sacrum all the way through the centre of the back. Curve, flexibility. The tissue, the fluids, the nerves. Protected. Sheaths protecting them, and then the vertebra. The discs. make up the spine. A sense of the spine lengthening. Like a tree rising up into the sky. Maybe you are a tree. Can you be a tree? Communicating with the trees out there, imagining that vast network of fungus underneath the earth. Perhaps you could also tap into that network. Just being open, receptive to everything you're experiencing as a body sitting here right now. Experience of the external world, place you're sitting, the environment you're in. Interior of your body, interior of your mind. And they're all one, really. They're not separate. So as you bring awareness to your breathing body, pay attention to the breath, breathing in the world. Breathing out, letting go, releasing from your body into the world. This body is not just the flesh and bone, the physical body. It's the subtle energy body, or more than one. Imaginal body. So you breathe in, breathe out. Experiencing the body, experiencing the breath, being the in-breath, being the out-breath. breath of life. And aware of all the other people on the retreat, sitting, meditating, breathing in, breathing out. Yeah, around us, this medium we live in, breathing in, breathing out, sharing this planet, all part of the planet, not separate. And in our imagination, just allowing ourselves to be aware of all the other living beings inhabiting the world, breathing in, breathing out. Trees and the plants, also breathing in, breathing out in their own way. Creatures in the ocean, breathing in their own way. You're just part of life. Part of this breathing world. You're just bodies. And our body is everything. Everyone's body is everything, the whole world, reality manifesting through your body, just as everyone else is also manifesting reality. As you bring awareness to your own experience, or how the ego likes to see it as your own experience, knowing that it's also an experience of reality. An opportunity to experience reality within your body, within your experience. any discomfort or pain, your physical body. Difficult feelings, emotions, thoughts, underlying state of mind. It's just dukkha. Don't take it personally, there is dukkha in the world. We're part of the world. There's dukkha. Breathing in, breathing out. Being aware of each breath. Beginning, the end of each breath, the flow of the breath. Each breath a reminder of impermanence, experience of impermanence. Also being aware of any other sensations in the body, some pleasant, maybe some unpleasant, coming into being, maybe some sticking around, some passing away, some changing. And if there's a pain somewhere, it's not just a fixed, unchanging pain. So just gently turning towards it, noticing sensations, flow of sensations maybe changing. Maybe it's not exactly as you imagine it will be, so just open to how things are, not what you expect, but what you're experiencing right now, seeing things as they are in this moment, your body and your wider experience, aligning yourself with reality. What's happening right now in your body, in your experience? And as you bring awareness to the breath, your body, your experience, who's experiencing it? There's an eye, where is that eye located? Head, your heart, your belly, your feet, your hands, your legs, particular organ. his physical body, energy body, thoughts, your imagination. You find an eye that is fixed and unchanging. There's everything in process, nothing fixed. What would it be like just to be open? Not think of things as me or mine. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself. And yet there's nothing that's not me, that's not mine, that's not myself. No inside, no outside, there's just the world. You're part of the world. We're all part of the world. Thank you. So when you're ready, just ending the meditation, coming back to the room, coming back to the shared space. And there's an open space. There's something you want to share, something you want to ask. Ideally related to meditation in the retreat. But see what emerges.
So I have a question.
Okay.
And it's a question from Sudhijaya, who is part of our retreat community, but she's meditating about 2 or 3 days behind the schedule. So this question is still from when Paramananda was talking about the fantasy of enlightenment. And I think Bodhilila also sort of talked about that a little bit. So Sudhijaya tends to think of her experience of bliss, no edges, made of light, and when there is no sensation at all, being a taste of enlightenment, a pure mind. But she says she's got strong eternalistic tendencies and still imagines that there'll be this pure land at the end of the road. So what's the best way to work with that? When you're prone to that eternalistic view, when you're prone to the fantasy of enlightenment.
I think it's just having that awareness, you know, that it's a view and it's a fantasy and it's not necessarily true, but we all do it, don't we? I've got a quote here that I was thinking of using tomorrow. It's like one's destination is never a place, but a new way of seeing things. But I think there's very much, especially if you use the metaphor of the spiritual path or the spiritual journey that you're getting from A to B, isn't there? That sometimes we go round and round. It's not like a straight line, but there's sometimes that sense, a bit like Paramananda was talking about this morning about there being a progression and things like that, which is just our way of thinking about it and looking at it, which is not necessarily true. I don't know. I'm just making it up as I go along, trying to find it out my own way as I go along. But I kind of feel that when you are in those kinds of spaces that Sudhajaya was describing, that they in a way give us a glimpse of something else, and that in a way they draw us to something else, and they get us out of that very ego, self-referential way of being and perceiving. And therefore they were part of that loosening, that giving that taste of freedom and liberation. And that there's something in us that kind of moves towards that, even if we can't consciously do it. So, you know, it's again, it's not causal, and you can't say, oh, I do this and then I'll get enlightened. I mean, I suppose the Buddha gave a whole lot of teachings and practices, you know, knowing that some people would work with some well or others and whatever. But it's in a way that invitation to create conditions by, you know, following particular teachings or doing particular practices, that we are sowing the seeds that may one day blossom into our Buddha nature or uncover our Buddha nature. I don't know. That's how I'm thinking about it today. Might be different tomorrow. What do you reckon, Paramananda? I know you're muted, but you might have a thought, and I'm sure.
I think Paramananda, could you please, Bodhilila, ask him to unmute from my end?
Okay. Did you get that, Paramananda? doesn't seem to be happening. What's happening?
Yeah. What was the question, sorry? I don't know. I suppose the thing I was thinking when I was listening is, you know, as far as we know, the historical Buddha, you know, he was very keen, wasn't he, saying that I teach the end of suffering, you know. A lot of this enlightenment stuff came afterwards, you know, the Mahayana, this more cosmic. I mean, and obviously, you know, we can have these oceanic experiences, which are very kind of useful, you know. But in a way, that wasn't, I mean, they're very prominent in the Hindu teaching, you know. They're not particularly Buddhist in a way. They were there. They were well established before the Buddha. You know, we can have a feeling of, but I mean, I suppose the question is, you know, does that stop us suffering at other times? You know, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think they're part of, you know, if we are using that idea of unfolding or path and things like that. I think those states of mind are really, really positive, and they do have a big influence, and they do create certain seeds conditions for the future.
Well, you might be right, yeah.
And I think
they weren't really what the Buddha was talking about, though, was it? Because presumably he experienced them with his teachers before his enlightenment. He didn't regard them as enlightenment, did he?
No, but I think, I don't know, my understanding from various suttas and things like that is that they are part of the path towards...
They're possible experiences, yeah. I'm not debating their useful experiences, perhaps. But the question was, you know, how do you have those experiences without interpreting them as eternalism, wasn't it? That's what I thought the question was about. She's having those sort of experiences, isn't she? Or did I misunderstand the question?
Well, it's suggested, yeah.
Yeah. So she's having those experiences, which, you know, If you're having those experiences, by all means enjoy them. Yeah. And yes, hopefully they are useful and supportive. Yeah. But you know, really, the problem is when we're suffering, isn't it? It's not when we're having lovely experiences. That's not the problematic bit of our lives, is it?
No, but I do think those experiences, when we have them, part of what makes them lovely is that we're not immersed in our normal, unskillful states and the craving and the aversion and all that sort of stuff. And there is that sense of freedom and liberation.
Yeah, well, I'm not disagreeing with you about it either. You seem to think I'm disagreeing with you. I think I've said...
No, I'm just trying to get somewhere. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just following on from your thinking.
I think they are useful, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but what I'm saying is that I don't think they should be necessarily equated with what Buddha meant by awakening, you know. Because, well, this is just my opinion, isn't it? I tend to see the Buddha as interested in how we live our life in this world, how we live our life. On a day-to-day level, how do we live our life? How do we react when we're ill or hurt or, all these, how can we change it, I think obviously those experiences might be very useful for us, but you seem to think there is some kind of fundamental shift that can happen that doesn't seem, from my understanding anyway, to be necessarily brought about by those experiences.
Yeah, no, sure, I'd agree with that. What brings about that turning around or that different way of... I suppose the thing is, none of us know, really. And a lot of it is stuff that can't be put into words or described in words or concepts. I mean, I couldn't say what enlightenment is.
Well, I think the main point, isn't it, that is deeply sort of paradoxical, isn't it? Because there's nobody there to get enlightened from a Buddhist point of view, is there?
No.
No, so that's why that's a tricky thing. It's not some personalized experience. It's not some, experience you can lay claim to. The very act of claiming it would undermine it. So we're in a very paradoxical sort of situation in a way. Once you identify, I suppose with those experiences, it's that's fine, but they shouldn't be over identified.
Well, I suppose that's why things like the Heart Sutra and the other Perfection of Wisdom teachings, where you've got all those sort of paradoxes that don't make sense cognitively. I don't know, the fact that, I always like the fact that the part of the Heart Sutra is saying that, there's no path, that the Four Noble Truths don't exist, that none of the teachings is that, there's no ignorance, there's no suffering, there's no attainment, there's no death, there's no anything. Yeah. And I think they're sort of trying to kind of stop us thinking that kind of way, isn't it? So I don't know, for me, that kind of stuff, reflecting on those, is another part of conditions that we can create and see where we end up. But yes, Panyanita, on behalf of Sudhajaya, don't know.
I think she'll be very happy with the answers. And I wonder whether there are any other people who might have a question or a comment or something they want to share.
There's something I would quite like to share, if that's possible. I'm Jackie, and I got an enormous amount from Paramananda's talk this morning. And like people have been saying, it's hearing things, going over the same things and hearing them again. And sometimes I think I'm very slow, but The question I'd like to ask, because I find his descriptions and his of Buddhist terms and Buddhist states so good to follow. I'd like to ask, how would he describe the state of I've lost the word now. When we take something in, when we when you absorb, whether it's information or food, or you retain it in the body, what do we call this? It's
ingest.
Sorry?
That be ingesting something?
It's not ingesting. You have, there's a word that's used all the time in
internalize.
No. I can't believe you better go away and leave me to think about it. It's so silly. I've been thinking about it so much and now I can't remember.
Assimilate?
No, it's an I.
Imbue, no.
Anyway, why not just
see just find another question
with a different word?
Insight. Yeah. Insight?
No, it isn't insight.
Mm. So, Jackie, is there a way of asking him without that word?
I don't think there is. It's a process of taking in information, or as I said, food, or experience, or any thing that's happening to you. And keeping it, what in the Buddhist term is about keeping it, retaining it in the body, so that we have it there for information, for, I'm really not time describing this well at all. This is why I wanted him to tell me. Please go to somebody else. And I'll try and write it down if I find it.
Okay, well, no way to come back to that.
You can see I can't understand it, or I wouldn't be.
Can I just say something there? I was just thinking back, when you said those moments of awakening or peak moments, is there that danger of then grasping them and that whole thing of not practicing non-attachment, if you know what I mean? Did that come across?
Not identifying with them too much. I think that's the thing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's great. You know, obviously, we all like to have kind of big experiences, but I think big experiences are a little bit overrated in a way. You know, because most of our life isn't made up of big experiences by definition, isn't it? Most of our life is fairly mundane, and that's really what we're dealing with. We're dealing with our life. You know, if we have, you know, so-called peak experiences or big experiences, yeah, that's fantastic, but I don't think that's a raise on depth for meditating, you know. I mean, some people do meditate for experience, but in the end, that becomes quite frustrating because big experiences are kind of relative. It's a bit like action movies, you know, they have to become louder and bigger. Everything has to get bigger and bigger, because if you have a lot of these experiences, after a while they're no longer peak experiences, you know. So, you know, there's a sort of subtle craving going on, isn't it? You want more and more experience. And I don't think we really meditate. It was too complicated to explain, really, but I would call those events, you know. I think the problem is making events into experience, which I think is perhaps what Jackie was trying to get at. There's some process, you know, you can have a big experience, and in the moment it can have a big effect. Then, you know, a couple of days later, you just forgot about it and you want another one. Or, you know, and most of us, by the time we've become adults, most of us have had enough experiences. We don't need more experiences. We need somehow for them to maturate and, you know, get into the bones in a way. It's not that we, want, you know, I feel quite sort of strongly about it. We don't need more and more experiences. You know, most of us have had enough experiences. We just haven't allowed them. And that, I think, the big problem with this kind of culture we've got now is you just go from one experience to another. And so those experiences never get a chance to sort of ripen properly or maturate properly or compost properly, whatever term you want to use. You know, I don't, you know, they just sort of, you know, does that make sense?
I was just saying that with them, there's that risk of grasping, which is what you're saying, really, trying to grasp onto them and get too attached to it.
Well, I wouldn't worry about there being a risk of grasping, because we will grasp. That's just what our egos want to do. Whatever our experiences are, it's sort of wanting to appropriate it and, you know, hold on to certain things or push other things away. And that's all just different ways of, you know, trying to control things and grasp and make things the way it wants to be. But I wouldn't say that because you might end up grasping onto an experience, then you shouldn't have the experience. It's too dangerous to have the experience in case you grasp onto it. But I think we can get a little bit addicted to the drama of our lives and having experiences, or think that that makes us special if we have experiences. And that's one way the ego kind of they grasp onto experience, you know, particularly if it's, you know, a peak experience, or we get into different sort of experience of reality, and then it's easy to interpret it as this really spiritual experience, and therefore I made progress, you know, and make a whole story about it in that kind of way, rather than there was this experience.
Yeah, because otherwise you'd get disappointed, as Paramanda was saying, if you didn't have more of them.
Can I come in a sec? The word I was looking for was embodiment. You'd think we'd pounced on it, wouldn't you? I mean, the state of embodiment was what I was trying to ask you to describe, and it's probably too late now.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, we could go back to sort of Bodhin Leela's analogy of learning a musical instrument, or learning anything in a way. You know, it takes a long time. This is what I mean by these experiences. Something has to happen. You know, we can have an experience, what we're calling an experience, what I would tend to call an event. You know, we can have a big event, and then we can just, if we just, you know, but for that, some other process has to happen for it to become an embodied event, be made into an experience, you know, or made in, I think one way of what I find is quite useful to think about the Buddhist path as having something to do with character, what the old idea of character, you know? So it's also got something to do with ethics. You know, it's not about having peak experiences, it's about development.
It's about retaining, isn't it? About holding those with it. I don't know why. Maybe I've got it exaggerated. I don't know.
Well, being able to stay with stuff rather than just want to have more and more stuff all the time, you know. It's like with poetry or music or anything, you know. You know, I mean, this is why I personally like to learn poetry by heart, because it's a completely different thing from just reading a poem off a page, you know. And it's the same with anything, really, you know. You know, people that love gardening have probably been doing it for years, you know what I mean? It sort of grows in you, doesn't it? You know, these things grow in us. It's not that we just have them and that's it, you know.
There's something about doing something again and again and again. I was thinking that actually around the puja. You know, like I like ritual, and there's lots of other, you know, pujas that people have written that have got really lovely language and imagery, and I like. But there's something about the basic Triratna and the Sevenfold Puja that, even though I think the verses, the translations could be better, and you know, until you actually are more familiar with it, you might not understand what they're all talking about and what the significance and the symbolism is. Just by having done it again and again and again and again over the years, it has become kind of a part of me, part of my psyche, part of my body kind of thing. And I think doing the Sevenfold Puja for me has a different kind of weight to it than when I'm doing, you know, this is a really nice, fancy, you know, poetic one that's new, you know. I don't like doing them, but there's something about that. That it's not just my conscious mind, my cognitive mind that's responding to it. There is actually an embodiment of it. There's a sort of physical experience of doing the puja. If that makes any sense.
Yes, I wanted to give it a special Buddhist meaning, and I don't know that there is. I don't know whether it is what the word says in the dictionary, you know, whatever it says. I'm making a big thing of it.
Well, from a meditation point of view, I quite like to think of meditation as a craft, you know, and craft kind of we sort of absorb them rather than, you know, over time, you know, to become a craftsman is like becoming a musician, isn't it? Something done and done and done again, you know. Meditation is a bit like that, isn't it? You know, I think it becomes a, you know, think of it as a craft is quite a good way of thinking about meditation. You know?
Yeah.
Rather than thinking about, well, I'm going to meditate because I want a big experience. Well, you might have big experiences, you might not. I think a lot of what we experience is temperamental. Some people are temperamentally inclined to have big experiences. You know? Other people are more sanguine. They don't necessarily ever have what seems to them. You know, I listen to some people talk about that meditation. And it's like, you know, being in Lord of the Rings. You know?
Yeah.
I don't like experience of meditation at all. My experience of meditation is quite sort of simple and not much goes on, but. Yeah. And one's right or wrong. I understand that it seems to me temperament, you know, partly to do with our basic temperament, you know.
Okay, so I'm aware of the time. It's getting really
interesting. Yes, I'm sorry.
We need to end now because it's past half past. But thank you, that was interesting. Oh, yes, okay. But yes, there's a post from Jyoti, about mastery coming to mind about spiritual skills and practice. Well, that's a whole big other thing, which maybe we can explore tomorrow a bit. We'll see. So thank you all for coming. And just, yeah, tomorrow's the last day. So maybe just bearing that in mind as you're sort of pacing yourself this evening and tomorrow.